Okay. Today is March 7th, 2013, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Etok Edwardson, Charles Edwardson Jr.
Yes.
Here in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we will be talking about his experiences with the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory in Barrow. So, Etok, thank you for being willing to be interviewed. So you started to tell me about your first memories or knowledge of the laboratory.
1948 was a big year of awareness for me. It was there was a Navy ships had come to Barrow. And it was the first time that I had seen a black person, and without any fear, I went to go and touch his hand because I had never seen a black person before.
Yeah,
and so this sailor, they were passing out. First time I had Coca-Cola was from a sailor, from this guy, okay? And he went back to the boat, and they were passing out, instead of opening them, they were giving cases to the people in Barrow.
Wow.
Cases of
Coca-Cola?
Coca-Cola.
Wow.
And so they had a baseball game in Barrow, and the Navy lost, and then my father's union in September had a strike, and I was painting picket signs for the signs of the picket. Operating engineers.
The operating engineers are the ones who drive heavy equipment?
Yeah. Their union had a strike. And that's where I first became aware that that there was a kitchen for blacks, kitchen for natives, and kitchen for Hoyts at the Barrow base.
At the Navy base?
At the Navy base. And so they struck on equality. The operating engineers struck for equality of the workplace and against discrimination of the natives and the blacks. Hmm. And was the first union that stopped discrimination.
Wow, I never knew that.
Yes.
So can we backtrack a second to tell me a little bit about yourself and when you were born? Because 1948, how old would you have been?
I was five.
Okay.
I was born August 5th, 1 a.m., at Barrow Clinic, and delivered by Mrs. Bob Blodgett and Nurse Kirshner at 1 a.m.
And are you the oldest in your family?
Yeah, I'm the oldest in my family.
Of how many children?
13. Okay. Two have passed on. Mm-hmm. There's 11 of us today.
And your father was Charles Edwardson Sr.?
Yeah.
And your mother was?
Mary
Edwardson.
Mary Nusanginya, right. Edwardson.
And can you tell me a little bit what your growing up life was like, growing up in Barrow?
I had a grand time growing up in Barrow. I was the first grandson of Ned Nusanginya and Faye and I had they took good care of me. I start stuttering ever since I was a kid, you know. And they took time with me and so I had and my great grandparents were still alive.
Wow.
So one of the chores that Beverly Nusanginya and I did was we chewed meat for our great grandparents, and making it soft enough for them to swallow.
Wow.
And we did that for a couple of years, and until that day had passed on.
Mm-hmm. So with your growing up, did you and your family spend a lot of time out traveling on the land? Your father had been a reindeer herder, hadn't he?
Yes. There's no such a thing as Brower herd. See, there was a federal law when they, that the Hoyt people cannot own reindeer. And so the reindeer herd was by Asiangatak. Asiangatak is my dad's and uncle's their grandmother. They're the first of his grandchildren. Her grandchildren,
right,
and they were not part of the Brower family.
Yeah, their father was Tony Edwardson.
No.
Anthony Edwardson wasn't.
No.
Okay.
No, she had an Eskimo husband.
Asiangatuk. Oh, okay. Yeah. Her first cousin from Point Hope, wasn't she?
Yeah, she's from Point Hope.
Right.
I mean, from what's that village down there? Seward Way.
Oh, Teller or Wales or someplace down there?
I think it was Teller.
Or Deering?
Huh?
Deering?
No.
Okay. Anyway, so she had a first husband, and she had children with that first husband before she married Brower. Did Asiangatuk have children with that first husband?
Oh, that I don't know.
Okay, but your father and Uncle George lived with...
With her, with their grandmother.
Right, okay.
See, my grandfather had a trading post at Beachy Point.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that big flu epidemic.
Right.
And they were the victims.
Okay.
And George Woods, Kisik, George Woods, mm-hmm. was, they were, Andrew Owen, George Woods and the two Kinyaviak brothers from Point Hope were and were working for my grandfather.
Okay.
My grandfather had a 52-foot schooner.
And that was at Beachy Point, you said?
At Beachy Point. He had two camps. One on the eastward side, I don't recall the name of, but Beachy Point was his headquarters.
Mm-hmm. And what was that grandfather's name?
Antone.
Antone. That's where I got Tony. It was Antone.
Anton Edvardsen.
Right. And then his wife was, what was her name? What was his wife's name, your grandmother's name?
Dora.
Dora, okay. Yeah. And I think Dora was Asiangatuk's daughter. Huh? Is that right?
No. Dora is Asiangatuk's name.
Oh, it's this, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That was her English name.
That was her English name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, growing up in...
And so they... So they went up to the reindeer herd, and my dad and Eddie were reindeer herders,
right?
So
did your family spend time out with the herd, or your dad went by himself?
No, my dad and they were herding the reindeer as kids.
Oh, okay.
Until that they were 16 or 17 years old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But then did you grow up traveling out on the land and pickpocket area?
Yeah. My dad had four places that were fishing spots, okay, hid on the Ikpikpak River. And we still own those four allotments, mm-hmm. on the Ikpikpak side. And they asked me if I wanted one. He says, "No, just give them to my brothers." He says, "I don't want nothing from you, from my folks. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had enough."
So did you start going to school in Barrow when you, the family came back to town so you could go to school?
Oh, my dad was working at the base.
Okay.
Yeah, he was an operating engineer. I mean, he was a heavy equipment operator.
How did he learn how to do that?
He's Norwegian.
He just got in one day and started to drive?
And my dad did all of the, he did exploration work, geophysical exploration work on NPRA with LVTs.
With what?
It's a land vehicle.
What did you call it?
Land track vehicle, LVT.
LVT.
Yeah.
Kind of like a weasel?
No, it's bigger, super weasel. It had two D8 engines.
Oh.
On each side of one track was powered.
Oh, okay. Those are big things.
Big things.
Those are sort of what they use for cat trains then?
Huh?
Did they use those on the cat trains?
No, they used those for the oil exploration work.
Okay.
Yeah. Because they were self-contained, lots of room, lots of gas, you know. It's just, my father did exploration work. See, there were no rednecks up there.
Mm-hmm.
None.
Right.
Yeah. And so they get to... They... So my grandfather, Ned Nusanganya, was the superintendent.
Oh, at the base?
At the base, yes. And he ran everything.
Oh. Do you know how they got hired? Like, was the Navy willing and interested in hiring Native people?
My grandfather was an intelligence officer for the United States Navy. Naval intelligence. Roy Amawak was naval intelligence. William Brower, the first William Brower, was a general... Light general in the army,
right?
And he appointed intelligence units, and Roy Amawak and Ned were in charge of Barrow as intelligence unit during the war.
Because I'm surprised that in 1948, when the Navy came to Barrow, that they would have been so open-minded as to hire Native people. I would think the Navy would have been pretty racist.
My grandfather was an intelligence officer in the United States Navy.
He
was a.
That's great.
I mean, and so as Roy was.
So they had status.
They had status, and Father Cunningham.
Was he the Presbyterian?
No. He was a Catholic priest.
Oh, Catholic priest, okay.
But he was in charge of the intelligence units, and he was their boss in the disguise of religion.
All right. So when Ned and your father worked for the Navy, did they help build the Navy camp there, like build the
runway? Yes, the whole thing.
Cool.
Yeah. My exploration work.
Right.
At Umiat. And did the whole geophysical. And so our father was always on the job someplace. Mm-hmm. And then the dew line came.
Okay. And did he work for the dew line?
Yes, all the way through. He's a business. When my father's union struck, my father was a business agent for the operating engineers. He did all of the hiring.
Well, I've always had the image of the Navy as being fairly insular, and that they brought in all the Seabees and all their own people for the construction, that they didn't use local people. So I'm happy to hear that they did.
Oh yeah, they didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. God, this is World War II, eh?
Right.
There was and so the only injustice that was was visible at that time was discrimination. There was a general in Alaska that was really racist, and the operating engineers struck for racial equality on the job site.
Mm-hmm. And did they win?
They won. They shut down the whole Pacific unit. I mean, the operating engineers, a big union out of Seattle, and all of the bases got shut down.
Wow.
It was big time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you know about any particular cases of discrimination in Barrow? Did your dad come home and talk about it? If people felt discriminated against?
No. My dad's a business agent,
right.
So
he liked working for the Navy.
No. The job was on a naval base, and my father was in charge of the operators. Okay.
Oh, so was he?
He was a business agent.
Right. Was Arctic Contractors already involved at that point?
Arctic Contractors came in.
Oh, okay. After that.
After that.
Okay.
Yeah. After it was organized.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then did Arctic Contractors hire...
All natives. My grandfather was their superintendent.
Oh, okay. He was superintendent for Arctic Contractors.
Yeah.
Was that when James Dalton was there?
Yeah.
Okay.
James Dalton, Thomas March.
So do you know how the natives and non-natives got along in those years on the job?
They were happy-go-lucky people, And it's not. I mean, It's not like any other place, okay? Barrow's very unique because the Eskimos did not, they knew their rights and knew how to assert them. They were not subservient to the white man, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I've read about that the Navy, when they were first there as a naval base, before the laboratory, that they had strict rules for their Navy people who couldn't leave the base to go into town. And so I've always wondered what the relationship was between town and the people on the base.
After the strike, when Truman equalized the bases, shit was over.
Mm-hmm.
That union strike of the operating engineers created equality for the first time in the history of the United States at the workplace.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it cut it all off, mm-hmm. you know? And that's where it started, from the operating engineers.
Cool. That's pretty neat.
Dave Beck.
Who's Dave Beck?
The president of operating engineers.
Okay.
Union president.
Okay.
He's got a big name for him at University of Washington.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when the Navy base was first starting up, local people and the people who lived on base could go back and forth freely?
Yeah. There were no restrictions.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we did not notice it.
Okay. So now when the lab when the Naval Research Lab started, that was in 46, I no, think, 48?
48.
Okay. And so how did you end up getting involved with NARL?
Well, it's just I'd go talk to whomever wants to talk to me. I did a lot of walking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, what is that? 3 miles
four.
Out? 4 miles? So what was your first job with NARL?
I was an expediter. No, my first job with NARL was on Arliss 2.
And Arliss 2 was the ice island.
Ice island. Frankie Ochpik and I took over the occupation of the island.
What year would that have been?
61.
Okay.
And we took over the occupation of the island, and the people start coming after we secured it.
What? Okay, what did you mean you took over the occupation? Could you explain more?
We made the discovery of Arliss 2.
Okay.
And Frankie Ochpik, myself, and Joe Felder were the first people that took the landing on the island.
Okay.
The Expendables. All Eskimos.
In case they drop you and went right through.
And
so how did they drop you from a helicopter?
Or no, we landed.
Okay.
Yeah. It was an ice island. And it looked like you're up in the mountains someplace.
Hmm.
We have a obelisk that was about 45 feet high on top of a glacial moraine. This was this ice island came broke off from the Ellesmere ice shelf.
Mm-hmm. So it was multi-year ice.
Yeah, I mean super.
Yeah.
Super ice.
Do you know how thick it was? Did you guys ever measure it?
It's probably 113 feet.
Wow. So how was it discovered? Somebody was flying around out there?
No, we were on a mission to find out what the to find out a safe place. So we had to find hiding places for our submarines.
Oh.
It says we're shooting first geophysical shots that cover from Peters Lake. We had a receiver at Peters Lake, and we shoot every 4 hours because we're looking for a whole array of things where to hide our submarines was the mission.
And did you find places to hide submarines?
Yes, we did. And my uncles wrote it out on the Atlantic. Oceans, rivers of currents. We were from the Ellesmere Island on the Atlantic current drift, and we went back out on the Atlantic side.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle Raymond and Percy wrote it out on the Atlantic side.
So that's Raymond
Ipaluk. And Percy Nusanginya were the last. They terminated the project.
That was on Arliss 2.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know Frankie was on one that he ended up in Greenland.
Well, we've been to
but that may have been...
No, that's the same island.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't T3. Okay.
Yeah.
So there was Arliss 1, which was the first... And Arliss stands for Arctic Research Lab.
Ice Island.
Ice Island, right.
Yeah.
And there was Arliss 1. That was
no, T3.
T3 was the first one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's when the Air Force had it, Colonel Fletcher.
Okay.
Colonel Fletcher started this search. And when T3 got stuck, we had to find another island.
Oh, it got stuck. It didn't break up.
Huh?
Where did it get stuck?
About 90 miles south of Barrow. North.
Southeast? No, southwest?
It was 90 miles northwest of Barrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they abandoned it. And then whoa. You're attached.
This is T3.
You have photos of T3? Oh. Where'd these come from?
From Japan.
Wow. Well, is that T3?
Yeah.
Oh, that looks like Gnarl, the base. These houses on pedestals as it was melting.
They're military.
That's right, it all looks the same, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. Cool. So was this a Japanese person who was out there?
These were Japanese scientists.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. They sent you those. Wow.
This was we met at the science conference in 99, and so he sent me this stuff.
Cool. Okay, so this shows T3 with where the campsite was. Neat, and how thick the ice was. What they were measuring.
Yeah.
Cool. And so after T3 was abandoned, then Gnarl went to find its own.
We were on a mission to find, and we found it. It didn't take us very long.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Felder, Frankie, and I.
Joe Felder was a pilot, wasn't he? Yeah.
He's from Unalakleet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But he married
Jenny Brower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frankie's wife's twin.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So. what was it like when you got to Arliss 2?
Oh, it was lots of fun.
What did you do there?
We shoot every 4 hours to receive a signal to Peter's Lake.
Uh-huh.
And we're not in the base. We're outside of the base, where only people that with clearance can go.
Oh.
Okay. And everybody else was support.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So when you guys landed there with the airplane, you decided this is the spot?
This is the spot.
What made you decide that that was the
place?
Well,
it was big enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you guys built a camp there?
Yeah.
Or did they brought in other people to help you?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How many people ended up living there?
Oh, it's... it was about with scientist support, about 25 people per shift.
Mm-hmm. And what was a shift?
Maybe 6 months, 9 months.
Okay.
4 months. We alternated. Another crew comes in.
Mm-hmm. So how did you guys all get along? You're in close quarters for 4 months. That's a long time.
We play hearts. See, so we get rations. Okay, this was a Navy operation. So from 4 to 6 is happy hour. Okay, we're on the Navy schedule. Uh-huh. You know. And we all had ranks. I was a lieutenant commander at 17 years old, you know. and we were the mission.
Uh-huh.
The United States government didn't trust their own people. So they trusted Inupiats.
Well, the Inupiat know a little bit or thing or two about sea ice.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And
it's just like all those old British explorers. If they'd listened to the Inupiat, they would still be alive.
Yeah. Oh, what's his name?
Franklin, that guy?
Yeah. That jerk.
So you said you had rations. What kind of stuff did you eat out there?
We had everything. I mean, we had a good chef, you know.
Was it fresh food or was all canned?
No, fresh food. We had airdrops. You know, we were they drop food in the summertime. We were well cared for.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of beer.
Really? You'd think that's surprising that the military provides you beer.
No, we're part of the military.
I know, but nowadays the military's not so keen on those things.
Well, they have different manual for the Arctic, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're more generous.
And so you guys were out there all year round, in the winter too?
24 hours a day we shot.
Wow.
Yeah, every 4 hours
mm-hmm.
to take a picture. And right from Peter's Lake on, we had a view, an expanding view. And in my tour of duty, when I got on my return home, we were 679 miles north-northwest of Point Barrow from 123 miles.
Wow.
So you see how fast...
So you started at 123 miles from Barrow?
Yep.
Wow. And so in 4 months you went 500 miles?
Yes.
Wow. That's moving. So what were there other scientists doing research out there besides your geophysical... shots?
It's just, that's the whole thing.
I didn't know if there were scientists studying the ice or anything.
There were support, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the geophysical part you were doing was related to looking for places for submarines?
Yeah.
And so that's like mapping the sea floor?
Yeah, mapping the whole array of ocean.
Okay. And then when you brought up those pictures of T3, it shows the buildings up on pedestals.
That's one summer melt.
That was so. Your camp, the same thing happened. Your buildings were kind of up on these pedestals.
We took care of ourselves, you know. Before it went to that level, we always had a secured camp because we had a lot of manpower.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So you would dig out the buildings so they would keep sinking?
Yeah.
Okay.
We took care of that.
Mm-hmm. So did you guys have a bunk? Was one of the buildings a bunk room? And you all?
No, we all had private rooms.
Wow.
Yeah.
So everybody had a private little cabin?
Two in a cabin.
Okay. So who did you share a cabin with?
With a black biologist. And four to six, and supper starts at six.
Mm-hmm.
We had Navy schedules.
And breakfast was at 0600 or something?
Yeah, seven.
But you were lucky you had a cook. That's pretty nice.
Oh, yeah, he was great.
Mm-hmm. And how long was Arliss II occupied? What year was that? You said you
78.
That year you found it was 78?
No. In 61. 61.
Okay.
May 23rd, 61.
Okay, and then it was a bit. Percy and them wrote it out in 78?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you ever have a problem with the ice breaking up or the runway being?
We've on my first landing on it was too soft, and then we made a front nose dive on the airplane.
Oh yeah, you nosed in.
Huh?
The nose went in when.
Yeah.
It
was too heavy up front, so it nosed in.
And did that damage the propeller?
Yes, it damaged the propeller, and we had probably 15 mechanics. Fred Aguiar ran the maintenance of all of the aircraft. He was an A&E.
What's an A&E?
Aircraft and engines.
Okay.
He was a first class mechanic.
So all of the airplanes were owned by
NARL.
NARL?
Yeah.
Their
government.
Yeah. What did they call it? The NARL. Not the Here, we'll pause for a second.
The support system of NARA, giving support to all of their food, whatever that they needed, you know. And Lloydie Pollock and I ran that operation.
Okay. So that is you and Lloydie Pollock.
Yeah, we were. We did the life supports operation for the fuel activity. The Arctic Research Laboratory, when the Navy shut down, the lab took the functions of the of the base.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the Navy shut down, the Arctic Research Laboratory went on a full swing until Nixon cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was 1980, though, isn't that when UIC took it over?
No.
I have it written down someplace. But I know that there was a long period of transition, so the Inupiat took over the old lab and the base. And
well, that was deed. We had the deed. Okay.
Right.
And so what happened was... The local leaders were slow in producing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Browers, the Hobsons, and they were fighting amongst themselves, with the formation of the Inuit Second Polar Conference, I was able to take charge and made plans for articulating Arctic policy for the United States is what I achieved.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what ICC is all about.
Yeah.
Right.
And so with that, when they shut down the scientific portfolio. The base was there, and so that it was going to be deeded to us,
mm-hmm.
And so I made the initiative to establish Arctic science policy for the United States under the leadership of Patsy Mink.
Okay.
Patsy Mink was the Assistant Secretary of State for okay. Oceans, and it was her. She supported us completely of getting into science contracting with the research councils of United States.
Okay.
And so cool. Patsy Mink is our shining star here.
Well, I want to go back a little bit. You started to talk about running all the supplies. You were the expediter?
Yeah.
That's what you did. So that was after Arliss 2?
Yeah, that was after Arliss 2. And I did all of the field work for the scientists. Mm-hmm. So I got to know a lot of scientists. Lloyd Pollock and I ran that operation,
uh-huh.
and pickups and the working with when the Navy shut down, the NARL took over the base,
right?
And I ran the base for about 3 years.
Okay, so what did that entail, running the base? What kind of things?
The whole thing, keeping it going.
So what kind of things did you do?
We had a good crew,
mm-hmm.
good Eskimo mechanics crew. We were self sufficient,
mm-hmm.
and we had no fights. Nothing. It was happy go lucky.
Mm-hmm. Did people like working for the lab? Was it a good place to work?
It was a fun place.
Mm-hmm. You didn't feel any discrimination?
No. We did the discrimination. Who we didn't like.
Like, what would you do to somebody?
We would fix it somehow, you know. We've got full of tricks.
Yeah, like sugar in their gas tank or something?
No, not that extreme.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how those scientists were, if they were all...
Some were nicer than others, but the scientific community was pretty damn... they were sharing and caring people.
Mm-hmm. Well, for many of them, their lives depended on the Inupiat people.
Yeah, well, it's just that we were the life support, you know. Mm-hmm. We supported their portfolios because it was not a choice. It was we had to do it. No, yeah. We were in charge.
Mm-hmm. And well, I know that Max Brewer often has said that he made sure that a Native person always went with a scientist because he knew that the Inupiat knew the land and survival, and those scientists didn't.
Yes, I mean all of the scientists, the leadership after Max did the same. John Schindler and
John Kelly.
John Kelly, you know, they're great people. They're kind people.
Mm-hmm.
They did a. When Nixon shut the base down, you know, it was a great opportunity for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly was a big once the Navy came, it was a big employer for people in Barrow. Before that, there weren't many jobs.
Yeah.
So I would think people in Barrow.
Well, there was a dew line, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But between the Navy and then the laboratory, that's a lot of jobs, I assume.
And NPRA, okay?
Right.
Don't forget NPRA.
Okay, for the exploration.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've wondered if people in Barrow liked having those places there because it gave them jobs.
Well, it's just, that was the only show in town, you know? And my grandpa was the superintendent, you know?
Right.
He hired and fired.
Right. That's great. So when you were the supporting science, did you go out and work on the field with some of them?
Yeah. Sometimes this is I take my leave off and go mountain hiking up in the mountains.
Uh-huh.
I take my time off at Peter's Lake and go up the mountains.
Nice. That must have been beautiful.
Oh, it was. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah. So can you remember some of the scientists you worked with and what you'd helped them with?
Oh, what's his name? There were, on the lateral drift, the intertidal erosion of the Arctic coast.
Mm-hmm.
What were those two guys' names?
What did you do with them? I can figure out their names probably later, but...
Oh, we were... I would sit in their rowboat and talk to them because they were my friends,
mm-hmm.
and I stuttered, and they had the time and the courage to be nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit in their rowboats with them, and they're telling me the science of their activity,
mm-hmm.
and it was remarkable and highly appreciated experience.
Yeah,
and so I learned how the westward and the eastward ocean rivers of currents are.
Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to learn the science.
Yeah, with them.
Yeah, to be out there with them.
Yeah.
So were you the one rowing the boat?
Or no.
Were you helping with their equipment?
No, sometimes I do their do little things, you know. But they took the time with me, and I tell them about what I know about our shoreline, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you feel like they were listening to you and respecting your knowledge?
Yeah. There was no ounce of racism, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It was give and take.
Well, their lives depended on you guys. So you'd hope they'd be nice.
Yeah, they were, you know.
But I can imagine that there are some individuals who perhaps were not always as appreciative.
It's just we had one guy from on the ice island that we didn't like. He was elitist Yankee.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, from Yale. Bunch of assholes.
So you just stayed away from him? Is that how you...
Well, we didn't care what he said, you know. We ignored him.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the other thing I was wondering about, on whether at Narl or out on the island, how much natives and non-natives interacted with each other, or did you kind of keep to your own groups?
No, we were well in. I mean, our superintendent was an old Navy type, you know. He stuck to himself, and then our station chief, and he just tell us what had to be done that way, and he never interfered. Mm-hmm. because he knows that we know what we're doing, and he was a foreigner. Mm-hmm. You know, foreign to the environment,
right?
So we had a great association with scientists. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that like on Fletcher's Ice Island, when that murder was committed, you know, and I've got the court case here in my files. Mm. And he did us a job. It proved that the United States had no jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. That it was an incident, but it was not murder.
So
the United States law did not apply.
Uh-huh. Can you refresh my memory of what the details of that case were? What happened?
They were filtering methanol gas and getting the alcohol out of methanol.
So they could drink the alcohol?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
And Donald Levitt was the labor, and there was a black man and a Weather Bureau guy, and one was fearful of his there was a faulty rifle. Mm. And he thought that it was Donald Levitt who was going to come in after him, so he shot the guy, and it was not Donald.
Oh.
Oh yeah.
So had they all been drinking? Is that
they're in the Enterprise?
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe the fumes.
So this went all the way up to the Second Circuit, and I've got the trial here, and it's a very important case for us because United States has never filed an Arctic claim.
Hmm.
Okay? In all of its life.
Hmm.
To this day.
Huh.
So we're the only claimants that the United States is hanging on to. Mm-hmm. Is us.
Yeah.
And so in 1971, when I formulated the Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope, mm-hmm. We had a declaration of our holdings, This was prior to the passage of the Land Claims Act, and so I had already been preparing because of the incident that had occurred on Fletcher's Ice Island. And I, knowing the legal circumstance, I was in Washington, D.C. when I went to go see their trial.
Oh.
Yeah. And I was in D.C. I was in D.C. lobbying for land claims.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I went to go see it. And so they had good lawyers.
Yeah, well, I'd be interested to see the court case. That would be interesting to read.
Okay, yeah.
I'll
find it. Or if not, I'll call up my cousin, Harry. Harry Lord has a copy, if I can.
Because I've heard of the case, but I didn't remember the details of exactly.
Well, it's
what
a very important case where the United States have no jurisdiction.
Yeah, I didn't know about
in the Arctic.
Yeah, I didn't know about that aspect of it.
I mean, it's really powerful.
I'm not a legal scholar like you to know that. So.
But I'll find the location of it.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's very important for us. And so. So we're the only claimants in the Arctic that the United States. So in the formation of the Inupiat community of the Arctic slope, prior to the law of the sea, I declared the 200-mile boundary with the Inupiat community of the Arctic slope.
Okay.
And now for the first time, I'm going to make a move and get my cousin out. So we can secure our position, and we're the only claimants to the Arctic, not the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And where the United States witnessed this transaction, they're our witnesses.
Right.
In the formation of the Inupiat community, and it was done in peace.
Always.
Yes.
Always in peace. Well, I have a question back about you talking about working with the scientists. That I felt, from my outside perspective, felt like the Inupiat did so much to help those scientists, and scientists write reports, and they rarely would acknowledge. So-and-so helped me, or so-and-so did this on the project. Did the Inupiat feel left out?
No.
No?
No, we're not that way. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't, their choice of stupidity is theirs.
Okay.
So it gets even, you know, but we let them know when it gets irritable.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples?
Well, I've put a few fights on during happy hour.
Mm.
I got the same reach as Cassius Clay. See?
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't want to be on the other end of that fist.
No, I have the same reach as Cassius Clay, and I'm a short guy with long arms.
Uh-huh.
You know, and most guys don't have my arms.
Mm-hmm.
I got twirling arms. Long.
Yeah. So some of those happy hours got into some fighting, huh?
Yeah.
When I can, knowing you, the little bit that I know you, I can't imagine that you would silently sit by if there was something you didn't like.
No.
Some other people maybe, but I don't.
Well,
know that you would have.
I was not bashful. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And I stand on my ground, and I never surrender.
Right. Well, that's why I wanted to ask you these questions. Some other people might say, oh, you know, gloss it over, but I felt you would be honest with me about how things really were at that time.
Well, there were in most scientists were genuine seekers mm-hmm. of their work, you know, and there were very and